Oh, she phoned this one in, is that it? Lonsman checks the timestamp. That morning at 5:30. She used the automated system, yes, most people do. Peril Strait, Lonsman says. That's where? Out by Tenneke, right? South of there. So we're talking about a what, a 2-hour flight from there to here? More or less. I guess she was feeling optimistic, Lonsman says. She put her arrival time at 6:15, 45 minutes from the time the thing was filed. Spiro has the kind of mind that is drawn to and repelled by anomaly. He takes the folder from Lonsman and turns it around. He pages through the stack of documents that he collected and copied after agreeing to let Lonsman buy a mistake. She did arrive at 6:15, he says. It's noted right here in the AFSS log, 6:17. So either, let me get this straight, either she made the 2-hour hop from Peril Strait to Yakovy in less than 45 minutes, Lonsman says, or else she changed her flight plan to come to Yakovy when she was already en route and heading someplace else. The stakes come. The waitress takes away their number on its pole and leaves their thick slabs of Canadian beef. They smell good and they look good. Spiro ignores them. He has forgotten his drink. He sifts through the pile of pages. Okay, here's the day before. She flew from Sitka to Peril Strait with 3 passengers. She took off at 4 and closed out her flight plan at 6:30. Okay, so then it's dark when they get there. She's planning to stay overnight. Then the next morning... Spiro stops. Huh. What? I'm guessing this was her original flight plan. Looks like she was planning to go back to Sitka the next morning. Originally. Not to come here to Yakovy. With how many passengers? None. After she's been flying a while, supposedly headed for Sitka, and alone but actually with a mystery passenger on board, she suddenly switches her destination to Yakovy. That's how it looks. Peril Strait, Lonsman says. What's in Peril Strait? What's anywhere? Moose, bears, deer, fish... Anything a Jew wants to kill. I don't think so, Lonsman says. I don't think this was a fishing trip. Spiro frowns, then gets up and goes over to the bar. He sidles up to the American pilot and they converse. The pilot looks wary, perhaps constitutionally so, but he nods and follows Spiro back to the booth. Rocky Kitka, Spiro says. Detective Lonsman. Then he sits down and takes care of his steak. Kitka has on black leather jeans and a matching vest worn over his bare skin, which is covered from wrists to throat to the waistband of his pants in native-themed tattooing. Big-toothed whales and beavers and down his left biceps a snake or an eel with a sly expression in its eye. You're a pilot? Lonsman says. No, I'm a policeman. He laughs with a touching sincerity at his own display of wit. Peril Strait, Lonsman says. You've been there? Kitka shakes his head, but Lonsman disbelieves him at once. Know anything about the place?
Just the way it looks from the sky.
Kitka, Lonsman says. That's a native name.
My father's Tlingit. My mother's Scotch-Irish and German and Swedish. Pretty much everything in there but Jew.
Lots of natives at Peril Strait?
Nothing but,
Kitka says it with simple authority, then recalls his claim not to know anything about Peril Strait, and his eyes slide away from Lonsman's, lighting on the steak. He looks extremely hungry. No white people?
1 or 2, maybe, tucked away back in the coves.
And Jews, Lonsman says? Kitka gets a hard look in his eye, a protective look.
Like I said, I just know it to fly past.
I'm making a little investigation, Lonsman says. It turns out there might be something over there to interest a Jew from Sitka.
That's Alaska over there, Kitka says. A Jewish cop, with all due respect, he can ask questions all day long in that neighborhood, isn't nobody has to answer them.
Lonsman slides over in the booth. Come on, sweetness, he says in Yiddish. Stop looking at it. It's yours. I didn't touch it.
You aren't going to eat it?
I have no appetite. I don't know why.
It's the New York, isn't it? I love the New York.
Kitka sits down and Lonsman slides the plate toward him. He drinks his cup of coffee and watches the 2 men destroy their dinners. Kitka looks much happier when he's done, less wary, less fearful of being set up.
Shit, that is good meat, he says.
He takes a long swallow of ice water from a red plastic schooner. He looks at Spiro, then away, then back at Lantzman, then away again. He stares into the water glass.
"Price of a meal," he says bitterly. Then, "They got some kind of honor ranch, I hear, for religious Jews that get hooked on drugs and whatnot. I guess even those beards of yours, they get into the drugs and the drinking and the petty crime."
"That makes sense. They want to put it someplace out of the way," Spiro says. "There's a lot of shame involved."
"I don't know," Lantzman says. "It's not easy to get permission to start a Jewish business of any kind on the other side of the line. Not even a do-good business like that." "Like I said," Kitka says, "I just heard a few things. Probably it's bullshit."
"Weird," says Spiro. He's in the world of the dossier again, flipping back and forth among the pages.
Lantzman says, "Tell me what's weird."
"Well, I'm looking through all this, and you know what I don't see? I don't see her flight plan for the fatal one. Yaakovy back to Sitka." He takes out his chauffeur and hits two keys and waits. "I know she filed one. I remember seeing it. Bella, Spiro, are you busy?" "Uh-huh. Okay, listen, can you check something for me? I need you to pull a flight plan from the system." He gives the on-duty manager Naomi's name and the date and time of her final flight. "Can you run that?"
"Yeah."
"Did you know my sister, Mr. Kitka?" Lantzman says.
"You might say that," Kitka says. "She kicked my ass one time."
"Join the club," Lantzman says. "That can't be," Spiro says, his voice tight. "Could you check again?" Now no one says anything. They just watch Spiro listening to Bella at the other end of the line. "Something's not right, Bella," Spiro says finally. "I'm coming back over there." He hangs up, looking as if his fine steak has begun to disagree with him.
"What is it?" Lantzman says. "What's the matter?"
"She can't find the flight plan in the system." He stands up and gathers together the scattered pages of Naomi's file. "But I know that can't be right because it's referenced by number right here in the crash report."
He stops.
"Or not?"
Again, he bats back and forth the pages of a thick-clipped sheaf of close-tight pages that comprise the results of the FAA investigation into Naomi's fatal encounter with the northwest slope of Mount Dunkelblum.
"Somebody's been in this file," he says at last, unwilling at first, his mouth a slit. As the conclusion spreads through his mind, he relaxes into it, goes slack. "Somebody with weight."
"Weight," Lantzman says. "The kind of weight it takes, for example, to get permission to build a Jewish rehab center on BIA land?"
"Too much weight for me," Spiro says.
He slams the cover of the file shut, stuffs it under his arm.
"I can't be here with you anymore, Lantzman. I'm sorry. Thanks for the steak dinner."
After he goes, Lantzman takes out his cell phone and dials a number in the Alaskan area code. When the woman on the other end answers, he says, "Wilfred Dick."
"Holy Jesus," Kitka says. "Look out."
But Lantzman gets only a desk sergeant.
"The inspector ain't here," the sergeant says. "What's this about?"
"Maybe you heard something, I don't know, about some honor ranch out at Peril Strait," Lantzman says. "Doctors with beards."
"Beth Ticken," says the sergeant, as if it's an American girl whose last name rhymes with chicken.
"I know it."
This knowledge, his tone implies, has not brought him happiness, and is not likely to do so any time soon.
"I might want to pay a little visit there," Lantzman says. "Say tomorrow. Think that would be okay?"
The sergeant cannot seem to find an adequate reply to this apparently simple question.
"Tomorrow," he says at last.
"Yes, I thought I would fly out there, have a look around the grounds."
"Huh. What's the matter, Sergeant? This Beth Ticken place, is it on the up and up?"
"That calls for an opinion," the sergeant says. "Inspector Dick don't let us have those. I'll be sure to tell him you called."
"You have an airplane, Rocky?" Lantzman says, killing the call with his middle finger.
"I lost it," Kitka says, "in a poker game. That's how come I'm working for a Jew owner."
"No offense."
"That's right," Kitka says. "No offense. So let's say I wanted to pay a visit to this temple of healing out there at Peril Strait."
"I got to pick up tomorrow, actually," Kitka says. "Over to Freshwater Bay. I might be able to bend a little to the right on the way over there. But I'm not going to hang around with the meter running."
He grins a beaver tooth grin.
"And it's going to cost you a hell of a lot more than a steak dinner."
29. A badge of grass. a green brooch pinned at the collarbone of a mountain to a vast black cloak of fir trees. At the center of the clearing, a handful of buildings clad in brown shakes radiate from a circular fountain, linked by paths and separated by quilted patches of lawn and gravel. A pitch at the far end, chalked for soccer, ringed by an oval track. The place has the feel of a boarding school, a backwoods academy for wayward young wealth. Half a dozen men circle the track in shorts and hooded sweatshirts. Others sit or lie prone in the center of the field, stretching before exercise, legs and arms, angles on the ground. An alphabet of men scattered on a green page. When the plane dips a wing over the playing field, the hoods of the sweatshirts train on its fuselage like the muzzles of anti-aircraft cannon. From the sky it is hard to be sure, but in Lantzman's judgment, the men move and stand and stretch their pale long legs like youthful types in excellent health. Another fellow comes out of the folds of the forest in a dark coverall. He follows the arc of the Cessna, right arm crooked at the elbow and pressed against his face, making the call. "We have company!" Beyond the woods, Lantzman catches a flicker of distant green, a roof, a scattering of white clumps that might be piles of snow. Kitka muscles the plane around with a shuddering and a rattling and a groan, and then they fall out of the sky all at once, then a little at a time, and hit the water with a final smack. Maybe it was Lantzman doing the groaning. "I never thought I'd say this," Kitka says as the Lycoming engine drops into idle, and they can hear themselves think. "But $600 don't seem like quite enough." Half an hour out of Yakovy, Lantzman decided to spice up their journey with a judicious application of vomit. The plane was harrowed by the smell of 20 years of rotting moose flesh, and Lantzman by remorse at having broken his vow, taken after Naomi's death, to repudiate travel by very small airplane. Still, the display of air sickness remains an achievement, given how little Lantzman has eaten in the past several days. "I am sorry, Rocky," Lantzman says, trying to lift his voice up out of his socks. "I guess I wasn't ready to fly again yet." Lantzman's last trip by air was undertaken with his sister and her Super Cub, to no ill effect. But that was a good airplane, and Naomi was a skilled pilot, and the weather was fine and Lantzman was drunk. This time he risked the skies in a bitter condition of sobriety. 3 pots of bad motel coffee forked his nervous system. He flew at the joint mercy of a stiff chop blowing in from the Yukon and a bad pilot, one whose caution made him reckless and whose self-doubt made him bold. Lantzman swayed in the canvas webbing of the weary old 206 that the management of Turkle Regional Airways has seen fit to entrust to Rocky Kitka. The plane rumbled and juddered and shook. All the pins and bolts came loose from Lantzman's skeleton, and his head got turned around backward, and his arms fell off, and his eyeball rolled under the cabin heater. Somewhere over the Moor Mountains, Lantzman's vow backed up on him. Kitka throws open the door and leaps with the mooring line onto the floatplane dock. Lantzman staggers out of the cabin onto the graying cedar planks. He stands blinking, reeling, breathing deep lungfuls of the local air with its scouring smell of pine needle and sea wrack. He straightens his tie and settles his hat on his head. Peril Strait is a jumble of boats, a fuel pump, a row of weathered houses in the colors of a rusted-out engine. The houses huddle on their pilings like skinny-legged ladies. A mangy stretch of boardwalk noses among the houses before wandering over to the boat slips to lie down. It all seems to be held together by a craze of hawser, tangles of fishing line, scraps of purse seine strung with crusted floats. The whole village might be nothing but driftwood and wire, flotsam from the drowning of a far-off town. The floatplane dock appears to have no physical connection to the boardwalk or the village of Peril Strait. It is solid, well-built, new-looking, white concrete and gray-painted beams. It boasts of engineering and the logistical needs of men with money. At the shore end, it terminates in a steel gate. Beyond the gate, a winding metal stair has been whip-stitched up the hillside to a clearing at the top. Alongside the stairs, a perpendicular railway cuts straight uphill, with a railed platform to elevate what cannot go by stair. A small metal sign bolted to the railing of the dock reads Beth Tikkun Retreat Center in Yiddish and American, and beneath this, in American, Private Property. Lantzman fixes his gaze on the Yiddish characters. They look out of place and homely in this wild corner of Baranoff Island, a gathering of lurching little Yiddish policemen in black suits and fedoras. Kitka fills his Stetson with water from a tap mounted against the post of the dock and splashes down the inside of his plane, one hatful of non-potable water after another. Lantzman is mortified to have made this job necessary, but Kitka and Vomit appear to be old acquaintances, and the man never quite loses his smile. With the edge of a plasticized spotter's guide to Alaskan whales and fishes, Kitka squeegees out of the cabin door a compound of vomitous and seawater. He rinses off the spotter's guide, gives it a shake. Then he stands in the doorway, hanging from the arch by one hand, and looks down at Lantzman on the dock. The sea slaps against the pontoons of the Cessna and against the pilings. The wind blowing down from the Stikine River hums in Lantzman's ear. It stirs the brim of his hat. Over in the village, a woman's voice rises, ragged, bawling at her child or her man. There follows the parodic barking of a dog.
"Guess they know you're coming," Kitka says.
"Folks up top there." His smile turns sheepish, narrowing almost to a pout.
"I guess we kind of made sure of that.
I already paid somebody a surprise visit this week. It didn't work out so good," Lantzman says. He unpockets the Beretta, pops the clip, checks the magazine. I doubt they can really be surprised.
"You know who they are?" Kitka says, his eyes on the Sholem.
"No," Lantzman says. "I don't. Do you?"
"Seriously, bro," Kitka says, "if I did, I would tell you, even though you puked up my plane."
"Whoever they are," Lantzman says, driving home the clip, "I think they might have killed my little sister." Kitka mulls the statement as if searching it for weak points or loopholes.
"I have to be in freshwater by 10, he says with a show of regret.
"No," Lantzman says, "I understand.
Otherwise, bro, I would totally back you up."
"Hey, come on. What are you saying? This isn't your problem."
"Yeah, but I mean, Naomi, she was a fucking piece of work, though."
"Tell me about it."
"Actually, she never really liked me all that much."
"She could run hot and cold," Lantzman says, dropping the gun back into the hip pocket of his jacket. "Sometimes."
"All right, then," Kitka says, kicking a splash of water out of his airplane with the toe of one roper boot. "Hey, listen, you take care."
"I don't really know how to do that," Lantzman admits.
"You had that in common, then," says Kitka. "You and your sister."
Lantzman clatters down the dock and tries the knob on the steel gate just for fun. Then he tosses his satchel to the other side of the gate and clambers up and over the grill after it. As he goes over the top of the gate, his foot gets caught in the bars of the grill. His shoe falls off. He tumbles and spills down to the other side, landing with a meaty thud. He bites his tongue, and there's a salt spurt of blood. He dusts himself off and glances back at the dock to make sure Kitka got all of that. Lantzman waves to show that he's all right. After a moment, Kitka waves back. He closes the door of the plane. The engine snaps awake. The propeller vanishes into the dark sheen of its own revolution. Lantzman starts the long climb to the top of the stairs. If anything, he's in worse shape now than he was when he tried to conquer the stairway in the Shemitz's apartment building on Friday morning. Last night he lay awake on the stiff, gritty packet of a motel mattress. 2 days ago he was shot at and beaten in the snow. He aches. He wheezes. There's some kind of mystery pain in his rib and another in his left knee. He has to stop once halfway up to smoke a hortatory cigarette. He turns to watch the Cessna wobble and hum its way into the low morning clouds, abandoning Lantzman to what feels right then like a lonely fate. Lantzman hangs from the railing, high above the deserted beach and the village. Down below, on the crooked boardwalk, some people have emerged from their houses to watch him climb. He waves to them, and they obligingly wave back. He steps on the end of his papyrus and resumes his steady upward trudge. He has the rush of the waters in the inlet for company, the distant chuckling of crows. Then these sounds fade. He hears only his breathing, the chiming of his soles against the metal treads of the stairway, the creaking strap of his satchel. At the top, a whitewashed flagpole flies two flags. One is the flag of the United States of America. The other is a modest white number, blazoned with a pale blue star of David. The flagpole stands in a ring of whitewashed stones encircled by a concrete apron. At the base of the flagpole, a small metal plaque reads, "Flagpole erected through the generosity of Barry and Rhonda Greenbaum, Beverly Hills, California." A walkway leads from the circular apron to the largest of the buildings that Lantzman saw from the air. The others are no more than cracker boxes clad in cedar shake, but this one makes a gesture in the direction of style. Its roof is pitched and clad in ribbed steel, painted dark green. Its windows are fitted with transoms and mullions. A deep porch wraps the building on three sides, its pillars the trunks of fir trees, still wearing their bark. At the center of the porch, a wide set of steps leads up from the concrete walk. Two men stand on the uppermost porch step, watching Lantzman come toward them. Both have heavy beards, but no sidelocks, no hose, no black hats. The one to the left is young, 30 at the outside. He's tall, even looming, with a forehead like a concrete bunker and an underslung jaw. His beard is unruly, prone to black ringlets, with a whorl of bare skin on each cheek. His big hands dangle at his sides, pulsing like a couple of cephalopods. He wears a black suit with a generous drape and a dark rep tie. Lantzman reads the twitch of longing in the big man's fingers and tries to mark the vest for the presence of a gun. As Lantzman gets closer, the big man's eyes cool to a lightless black. The other man is about Lantzman's age, height, and build. He's gone softer around the middle than Lantzman, and he leans on a cane formed with a curve from some dark, glossy wood. His beard is charcoal streaked with ash, trimmed, almost debonair. He wears a tweed suit complete with vest, and he puffs a thoughtful pipe. He seems content, if not delighted, to see Lantzman coming his way. Curious, a doctor anticipating mild anomaly or a wrinkle in the usual presentation. His shoes are moccasin loafers, laced with leather thong. Lantzman stops at the bottom step of the porch and hitches up his satchel. A woodpecker rattles its cup of dice. For a moment, that and the hisses of pine needles are the only sounds. They might be the only three men in all of southeastern Alaska, but Lantzman can feel other eyes watching him through the partings of window curtains, through gun sights, periscopes, and peepholes. He can feel the interrupted life of the place, morning exercise, the rinsing of coffee cups. He can smell eggs scorched in butter, toasted bread.
"I don't know how to tell you this," says the tall man with the patchy beard. His voice seems to spend too long bouncing around in his chest before it emerges. The words come out thick, poured with a slow ladle. "But your ride just left without you."
"Am I going somewhere?" Lantzman says. "You aren't staying here, my friend," says the man in the tweed suit. As soon as he says the word friend, all friendliness seems to drain from his manner. "But I have a reservation," Lantzman says, watching the big man's restless hands. "I'm younger than I look." The sound like the bones in their bucket somewhere in the woods. "Okay, I'm no kid, and I don't have a reservation, but I do have a substance abuse problem," Lantzman says. "Surely that counts for something." "Mister," says the man in the tweed suit, coming down one step. Lantzman can smell the bitter shag he smokes. "Listen," Lantzman says. "I heard about the good work you people are doing here, all right? I've tried everything. I know it's crazy, but I'm at the end of my rope, and I don't have anywhere else to go." The man in the tweed suit looks back at the tall man at the top of the steps. They don't seem to have any idea who Lantzman is or what to make of him. All the fun of the past several days, in particular the torturous hop from Yakovy, seems to have rubbed off some of the gnaws from Lantzman's aura. He hopes and fears that he looks only like a loser, dragging his bad luck in a satchel over one arm. "I need help," he says, and to his surprise his eyes get hot with tears. "I'm in a bad way," his voice breaks. "I'm prepared to admit that."
"What's your name?" says the tall man slowly. His eyes are warm without amity. They pity Lantzman without taking much of an interest in him.
"Felnbeuger," Lantzman tries, dragging out the name from some ancient arrest report. "Lev Felnbeuger."
"Does anyone know you're here, Mr. Felnbeuger?"
"Only my wife, and the pilot, of course." Lantzman sees that the two men know each other well enough to engage in a furious argument without speaking or moving anything but their eyes.
"I'm Dr. Raboy," says the tall man at last.
He swings one of his hands towards Lantzman, like the payload of a crane at the end of its cable. Lantzman wants to get out of its way, but he takes hold of its cool, dry bulk.
"Please, Mr. Felnbeuger, come inside."
He follows them across the sanded fir planks of the porch. High in the rafters of the porch, he spots a wasp's nest, and he watches it for a sign of life. But it seems as deserted as every other structure on this hilltop. They come into an empty lobby, furnished, with a podiatrist's flair, in soft beige oblongs of foam, drab, low-pile carpet, egg carton gray. On the walls hang trademark trite scenes of Sitka life, salmon boats, and yeshiva bachelors, Cafe Society on Monastir Street, a swinging klezmer that might be a stylized Natan Kalushner. Again, Lantzman has the uneasy sensation that it has all been installed and hung that morning. This is no flake of ash in the ashtrays. The rack of informational brochures is well stocked with copies of Drug Dependency, Who Needs It, and Life, to Rent or to Own. On the wall, a thermostat sighs as if suffering from the tedium. The room smells of fresh carpet and extinguished pipe. Over the door to a carpeted hallway, an adhesive plaque reads, Lobby Furnishings Courtesy of Bonnie and Ronald Letterer, Boca Raton, Florida.
Have a seat, please, Dr. Raboy says in his thick, black syrup of a voice. Fligler?
The man in the tweed suit goes back to the French doors, opens the left panel, and checks the throw bolts at the top and bottom. Then he closes the panel, locks it, and pockets the key. He walks back past Lantzman, brushing against him with a padded tweed shoulder. Fligler, Lantzman says, taking hold of the smaller man's arm gently. You a doctor, too? Fligler shakes off Lantzman's hand. He produces a book of matches from his pocket. You bet, he says without sincerity or conviction. With the fingers of his right hand, he peels back a match from the matchbook, scrapes it into flame, and touches it to the bowl of his pipe, all in a single continuous motion. While his right hand is busy entertaining Lantzman with this minor feat, his left hand plunges into the pocket of Lantzman's jacket and comes away with the .22. There's your problem right there, he says, holding the gun up where everyone can see it. Watch the doctor now. Lantzman watches dutifully as Fligler raises the gun, considering it with a keen medical eye. But then the next minute a door slams somewhere inside Lantzman's head, and after that he gets distracted, for half a second, by the drone of 1,000 wasps flying in through the porch of his left ear. 30. Lantzman comes to on his back, looking up at a row of iron kettles. They dangle with precision on sturdy hooks from a rack 3 feet above his head. In Lantzman's nostrils, a nostalgic smell of camp kitchen, cooking gas and dish soap, scorched onion, hard water, a faint stink of tackle box, metal like a chill of foreboding against his nape. He's stretched out on a long stainless steel counter, hands cuffed behind his back, jammed up against his sacrum. Barefoot, drooling, ready to be plucked and stuffed in the body cavity with lemon and maybe a nice sprig of sage. I heard some crazy rumors about you, Lantzman says. Cannibalism I never heard.
I wouldn't eat you, Lantzman, affirms Barenstein. Not if I was the hungriest man in Alaska, and they served you to me with a silver fork. I don't much care for pickles.
He's sitting on a high stool to Lantzman's left, arms crossed under the skirts of his lush black beard. He's out of uniform in a pair of new blue dungarees, flannel shirt tucked in at the waist and buttoned almost to the top, a fat hide belt with a heavy buckle and black ranger boots, the shirt too big for his frame, the trousers stiff as plate iron. Except for the skull cap, Barenstein looks like a skinny kid done up as a lumberjack for a school play, bogus beard and all. With his boot heels hooked on the rail of the stool, the cuffs of his trousers hike to betray a few hose-pale inches of thin shank.
"Who is this Yid?" says the gaunt giant, Roboy.
Lantzman cranes his neck and takes in the doctor, if he is a doctor, perched on a steel stool of his own down by Lantzman's feet, bags under his eyes like smears of graphite. Besides him stands Nurse Fligler, cane hooked over one arm, watching a papyrus die in the custody of his right hand, the left hand tucked ominously into the hip pocket of his tweed jacket.
Why do you know him?
A panoply of knives, cleavers, choppers, and other tools is ranged along a magnetic rack on the kitchen wall within easy grasp of the industrious chef or Schlosser.
This Yid is a shamus named Lantzman.
This is a policeman, Raboy says.
He looks like he just bit into a bonbon filled with some acrid paste.
He carries no badge.
Fligler, the man had a badge? I found no badge or other form of law enforcement labeling, Fligler says. That is because I had his badge taken away from him, Berenstain says. Isn't that right, detective? I'll ask the questions here, Lantzman says, squirming to find the more comfortable way of lying on top of his own cuffed hands. If you don't mind. Doesn't matter if he has a badge or doesn't, Fligler opines. Out here, a Jewish badge means goat shit. I don't care for that kind of language, friend Fligler, Berenstain says, as I believe I have mentioned before. You have, but I can never hear it enough, Fligler says. Berenstain regards Fligler. In the pits of his skull, hidden glands secrete their venom. Friend Fligler here was all for shooting you and dumping your body in the woods, he says amiably to Lantzman, keeping his eye on the man with the gun in his pocket. Way out in the woods, Fligler says. See what comes along and gnaws in your carcass. That your treatment plan, Doc? Lantzman says, craning his head around to try to make eye contact with Raboy. No wonder Mendel Spielman checked out of here so quick last spring. They feed on the meat of this remark, gauging its flavor and vitamin content. Berenstain allows a modicum of reproach to flow into his poisonous gaze. You had the yid, says the look that he flicks at Dr. Raboy, and you let him get away. Berenstain leans close, craning in from his stool, and speaks with that menacing tenderness of his. His breath is stale and acrid. Cheese rinds, bread heels, grounds at the bottom of a cup. What are you doing, friend Lantzman, he says, way out here where you don't belong? Berenstain looks genuinely puzzled. The Jew desires to be informed. This may, Lantzman thinks, be the only desire the man ever permits himself to feel. I could ask you the same thing, Lantzman says, thinking that maybe Berenstain has nothing to do with this place, is only a visitor like Lantzman. Maybe he is working the same trail, retracing the recent trajectory of Mendel Spielman, trying to find the spot where the Rebbe's son crossed the shadow that killed him. What is this place, a boarding school for wayward Verbivers? Who are these characters? You missed a belt loop, by the way. Berenstain's fingers stray toward his waist. Then he sits back and makes a face that resembles a smile. Who knows you're here, he says. Besides the flyer. Lantzman feels a stab of dread for Rocky Kitka, flying upside down through life for hundreds of miles without knowing it. Lantzman doesn't know very much about these yids of Peril Strait, but it seems fairly clear that they can be awfully tough on a bush pilot. What flyer? He says.
I think we have to assume the worst, Dr. Raboy says. This facility is clearly compromised. You have been spending too much time with those people, Berenstain says. You are starting to talk like them.
Without taking his eyes off Lantzman, he unbuckles his belt and feeds it through the loop that he missed.
You may be right, Raboy.
He cinches the belt tight with a distinct air of self-punishment, but I would be willing to bet that Lantzman told nobody. Not even that fat Indian partner of his.
Lantzman is out on a limb, and he knows it. He has no support, no jurisdiction, no standing, not even a badge. He wouldn't tell anyone he was going to the Indianer lands, because he would be afraid that they would try to talk him out of it. Or worse, forbid him to go. They would tell him that his judgment has been impaired by his desire to avenge his sister's death.
Raboy wrings his eyebrows over his nose like a pair of fretful hands.
His sister, he says. Who's his sister? Am I right, Lantzman?
I wish I could reassure you, Berenstain, but I wrote out a complete account of everything I know about you and this operation.
Is that right?
The phony youth treatment facility.
I see, Berenstain says with mock gravity. The phony youth treatment facility. Quite a shocking tale.
A front for your partnership with Raboy and Fligler and their powerful friends. Lantzman's heart thrashes with the wildness of his guessing. He's wondering why any Jews would need or want such a large facility out here and how they could manage to persuade the natives to let them build it. Could they have bought themselves a piece of the Indianer lands to build a new McShtetl? Or was this going to be the transfer point for a human smuggling operation? Some kind of Verbiver airlift out of Alaska made without benefit of visas or passports. The fact that you killed Mendel Spielman and my sister to keep them from talking about what you were doing here, then used your government connections through Raboy and Fligler to cover up the crash.
You wrote all this down, did you?
Yes, and sent it to my lawyer to be opened in the case that I should suddenly, for example, vanish from the face of the earth.
Your lawyer?
That's right.
And what lawyer would that be?
Sender Slonim.
Send a Slonim, I see.
Berenstein says, nodding as if fully persuaded by Lantzman's claim.
A good Jew, but a bad lawyer.
He slides down from the stool, and the thud of his boots puts a period to his examination of the prisoner.
I'm satisfied. Friend Fligler.
There is a snick and the scrape of a sole against linoleum, and the next thing Lantzman knows, a shadow looms at his right eye. The space between the steel tip and Lantzman's cornea can be measured in the flicker of an eyelash. Lantzman jerks his head away, but at the other end of the knife, Fligler grabs hold of Lantzman's ear and yanks. Lantzman curls up into a ball and tries to roll down from the counter. Fligler smacks Lantzman's bandaged wound with the head of his cane, and a jagged star bursts across the back of Lantzman's eyes. While he's busy ringing like a bell of pain, Fligler turns Lantzman onto his belly. He climbs on top of him and jerks his head back and lays the knife against his throat.
"I may not have a badge," Lantzman says with difficulty.
He addresses himself to Dr. Raboy, whom he senses to be the least resolute yid in the room.
"But I'm still a Nas. You people kill me. It's a world of trouble for whatever you have going here."
"Probably not," Fligler says.
"Not in all likelihood," Berenstein agrees. "None of you yids is even going to be a policeman 2 months from now."
The thin string of carbon and iron atoms, that is the consequential feature of the knife blade, burns 1 degree hotter against Lantzman's windpipe.
"Fligler," Roboy says, wiping his mouth with one giant hand.
"Please, Fligler,"
Lantzman says.
"Cut my throat. I'll thank you for it. Go on, you pussy."
From the other side of the kitchen door comes a churn of agitated male voices. A pair of feet scrapes the floor, about to knock, and hesitates. Nothing happens.
"What is it?" Raboy says bitterly.
"A word, doctor?" says a voice, young, American, speaking American.
"Don't do anything," Raboy says. "Just wait."
Just before the door swings shut behind Raboy, Lantzman hears a voice begin to speak, a rush of angular syllables that do not register on his brain as anything but throaty noise. Fligler settles his weight more securely into the small of Lantzman's back. There follows the small awkwardness of strangers in an elevator. Berenstein consults his fine Swiss watch.
"How much of it did I have right?" Lantzman says. "Just so I know."
"Ha," Fligler says. "I could laugh."
"Raboy is a trained rehabilitation therapist," Berenstein says, with a show of tolerant patience, sounding remarkably like Bina when speaking to one of the 5 billion people, Lantzman among them, whom she considers to be on balance an idiot. "They were genuinely trying to help the Rebbe's son. Mendel's presence here was entirely voluntary. When he made the decision to leave, there was nothing they could do to stop him."
"I'm sure the news broke your heart," Lantzman says.
"What do you mean by that?"
"I suppose a cleaned-up Mendel Spielman was no threat to you? To your status as heir apparent?"
"Oi," Berenstein says. "What you don't know."
The kitchen door opens and Raboy slips back inside, eyebrows arched. Before the door bangs shut, Lantzman catches a glimpse of 2 young men, bearded and dressed in ill-fitting dark suits. Big boys, one with the black snail of an earphone curled in the shell of his ear. On the outside of the door, a small plaque reads, "Kitchen equipped through the generosity of Mr. and Mrs. Lance Perlstein, Pikesville, Maryland."
8 minutes, Raboy says. 10 at the most.
"Someone coming?" Lantzman says. "Who is it? Haskell Spielman? Or does he even know you're here, Berenstein? Did you come to cut a deal with these people? Are they moving in on Verbiver action? What did they want with Mendel? Were you going to use him to force the Rebbe's hand?"
"Sounds to me as though you need to read that letter of yours again," Berenstein observes, "or get Sendus Lonim to tell you what it says."
Lantzman can hear people moving around, chair legs screeching against the wooden floor. In the distance, the whir and click of an electric motor, a golf cart zipping away.
"We cannot do this now," Raboy says, coming close to Lantzman, looming over him.
His dense beard flocks his entire face from the cheekbones down, flourishing in his nostrils, winding in fine tendrils from the flaps of his ears.
"The last thing he wants is any hint of a mess. Okay, detective?"
His slow voice turns syrupy, abruptly warmer. A perfunctory affection suffuses it, and Lantzman stiffens, awaiting the bad thing that this surely betokens, which proves to be only a stick in the arm, quick and expert. In the dreamy seconds that precede his loss of consciousness, The guttural language that Lantzman heard Raboy speaking plays like a recording in his ear, and he makes a dazzling leap into impossible understanding, like the sudden consciousness in a dream of one's having invented a great theory or written a fine poem that in the morning turns out to be gobbledygook. They are talking, those Jews on the other side of the door, about roses and frankincense. They are standing in a desert wind under the date palms, and Lantzman is there, in flowing robes that keep out the biblical sun, speaking Hebrew, and they are all friends and brothers together, and the mountains skip like rams, and the hills like little lambs.
This ends Disc 6. The Yiddish Policeman's Union, Disc 7.
31. Lantzman wakes from a dream of feeding his right ear to the propeller blades of a Cessna 206. He stirs under a clammy blanket, electric but unplugged, in a room not much larger than the cot he stretched across. He touches a cautious finger to the side of his head, where Fligler originally sapped him. The flesh is swollen and moist. Lantzman's left shoulder is killing him, too. In a narrow window opposite the cot, metal slat blinds leak the disappointed gray of a November afternoon in southeastern Alaska. It's not light oozing through so much as a residue of light, a day haunted by the memory of the sun. Lantzman tries to sit up and discovers that his shoulder hurts so much because somebody has been kind enough to handcuff his left wrist to a steel leg of the cot frame. With his arm jerked up over his head, Lantzman practiced some kind of brutal chiropractic on his shoulder in the thrashing and tossing of sleep. The same kind soul who chained him was thoughtful enough to remove his trousers, shirt, and jacket, reducing him once again to a man in his underpants. He sits up on his haunches at the head of the cot. Then he eases himself backward off the mattress so that he can squat with his left arm hanging at a more natural angle, his shackled hand resting against the floor. The floor is yellow linoleum, the color of the inside of a used cigarette filter, and as cold as an ME's stethoscope. It features an extensive collection of dust lemmings and dust wigs and a winged smear of black fly grease. The walls are cinder block painted a thick glossy shade of dentifrice blue. On the wall beside Lantzman's head, a familiar hand has penned a tiny message for Lantzman in the mortar line between two cinder blocks. This detainment cell, courtesy of the generosity of Neil and Risa Noodleman, Short Hills, New Jersey. He wants to laugh, but the sight of his sister's droll alphabet in this place raises the hair on the back of his neck. Apart from the bed, the only other furnishing in the corner by the door is a metal wastebasket. The wastebasket is a thing for children, blue and yellow with a cartoon dog cavorting in a field of daisies. Lantzman stares at it for a long time, thinking about nothing, thinking about children's garbage and dogs in cartoons. The obscure unease that Pluto has always inspired, a dog owned by a mouse, daily confronted with the mutational horror of Goofy. An invisible gas clouds his thoughts, exhaust from a bus left parked with its engine running in the middle of his brain. Lantzman crouches by the cot for another minute or so, collecting himself like a beggar chasing scattered dimes along the sidewalk. Then he drags the cot to the door and sits down on it. In a way that is both methodical and wild, he begins to kick at the door with his bare heels. It's a hollow steel door, and it makes a thunderous sound when kicked that's pleasant for a moment, but then the pleasure palls. Next, Lantzman tries loud and repeated cries of, "Help me! I cut myself and I'm bleeding!" He yells until he is hoarse and kicks until his feet throb. At last he gets tired of kicking and yelling. He needs to urinate. Badly. He looks at the trash can and then at the door. It might be the trace of the drug in his system or the hatred he feels for that tiny room in which his sister passed her last night on Earth, and for the men who chained him, still in underwear, to it. Maybe all his enraged yelling has engendered an actual rage. But the idea of being obliged to piss into a schnappish-the-dog wastebasket makes Lantzman angry. He drags the bed over to the window and shoves the blinds rattling to one side. The windowpane is pebbled glass, ripples of a green and gray world set in a heavy steel frame. At one time, maybe until very recently, there was a latch, but his thoughtful hosts have removed it. Now there is only one way to get the window open. Lantzman goes for the wastebasket, dragging the cot back and forth behind him like a handy cymbal. He raises the wastebasket, takes aim, and hurls it against the pebbled glass of the tall window. It bounces off and flies back at Lantzman, striking him squarely in the forehead. A moment later, he tastes blood for the second time that day as it trickles down his cheek to the corner of his lips.
"Schnappisch, you bastard," he says.
He shoves the cot all the way over against the long wall and then, working with his free hand, tips the mattress off the cot frame. He stands the mattress against the opposite wall. He grabs hold of the cot frame on either side and, lifting from the knees, heaves it up off the ground. He stands there a moment, holding the rickety frame parallel to his body. He wavers under the sudden weight, which is not great, but taxes his strength all the same. He takes a step backward, lowers his head, and drives the cot frame through the window. Green lawn and fog blow into Lantzman's dazzled vision. Trees, crows, hovering hornets of broken glass, the gun-barrel-gray waters of the strait, a bright white floatplane trimmed in red. Then the cot frame jerks free of Lantzman's grasp and leaps through gaping glass fangs out into the morning. As a kid in school, Lantzman received good marks in physics, Newtonian mechanics, bodies at rest and in motion, actions and reactions, gravity and mass. He found more sense in physics than in anything else they ever tried to teach him. An idea like momentum, for example, the tendency of a body in motion to stay in motion. So maybe Lantzman should not be quite so surprised when the cot frame does not content itself with shattering the window. There is a sharp joint-popping tug on the bones of his shoulder, and he is seized again by the nameless emotion he felt when he tried to climb aboard Mrs. Spielman's moving limousine. The sudden awareness, like an inverse Satori, that he has made a grave, if not fatal, error. This is Lantzman's luck. He lands in a pile of snow. It's a furtive diehard patch tucked deep into the shadow on the north side of the barracks, the only snow visible in the entire compound, and Lantzman falls right into it. His jaws snap together, making each tooth ring out with its own pure tone as the impact of his ass against the ground conducts its Newtonian business with the rest of his skeleton. He lifts his head up out of the snow. Cold air flows over the back of his neck. For the first time since taking wing, he remarks on the fact that he is freezing. He stands up, his jaw still chiming. Snow streaks his back like welts raised by a wire lash. He lurches and staggers to the left under the weight of the cot frame. It offers to help him sit down again in the snow. Sink into it, plunge his sore head into the cold, clean pile of snow. Close his eyes. Relax. Just then he hears a soft scrape of soles coming from around the corner of the building, a pair of erasers rubbing away the marks of their own passage. A flawed gait, the extra hop and shuffle of a man with a limp. Lantzman takes hold of the cot frame and hoists it, then backs up against the shingled side of the barracks. When he sees one hiking boot, the tweed cuff of Fligler's trouser leg, he thrusts the cot frame out. As Fligler rounds the corner, the steel edge of the cot frame catches him full in the face. A red hand of blood spreads its fingers across Fligler's cheeks and forehead. His cane flies up in the air and strikes the pavement with a marimba note. The cot frame, as if shy without its best friend, drags Lantzman along with it, onto Fligler, in a heap. The smell of Fligler's blood fills Lantzman's nostrils. Lantzman scrambles to his feet, grabbing with his free hand for the scholem in Fligler's slack fingers. He raises the automatic, contemplating shooting the man on the ground with a certain black willingness. Then he glances toward the main house, 500 feet away. Several dark shapes are moving behind the French doors on this side. The door flies open, and the whole-mouthed pans of big young yids in suits fill the doorway. Lantzman envies them their youthful capacity for wonder, but still raises the gun in their direction. They duck and pull back, and in their parting a tall, slim, fair-haired man stands revealed. The new arrival, fresh from the hold of his bright white floatplane. The hair is really something, like a flare of sunlight on a sheet of steel. Penguins on his sweater, baggy corduroy pants. For an instant, the man in the penguin sweater frowns at Lantzman, looking confused. Then somebody drags him back from the doorway as Lantzman tries to take aim. The cuff digs into Lantzman's wrist, sharp enough to abrade the flesh. He changes his aim, pointing the gun at his own left arm. He squeezes off a single careful shot, and the handcuff slides free, a bangle at his wrist. Lantzman lowers the bed frame to the ground with an air of mild regret,
as if it's the body of a bumbling but loyal family retainer who has served the Lanceman's well. Then he takes off into the woods toward a gap in the trees. There must be at least 20 young healthy Jews running after him, shouting, cursing, giving orders. For the first minute he expects to see the branching lightning of a bullet in his brain, and to go down underneath the slow roll of its thunder. But there is nothing. They must have been given orders not to shoot. The last thing he wants is any hint of a mess. Lanceman finds himself running along a dirt road, neat and well-maintained, marked with red reflectors on metal stakes. He remembers the distant patch of green that he caught sight of from the air, beyond the forest, dotted with piles of snow. He figures this path must lead there. It must lead, at any rate, somewhere. Lanceman runs through the woods. The dirt track is thick with fallen needles that muffle the thud of his bare heels. He can almost see the heat departing his body, shimmering waves of it that trail along behind. He has a taste at the back of his mouth that's like the memory of the smell of Fligler's blood. The links on the broken chain dangle from the handcuff, tinkling. Somewhere a woodpecker is knocking out its brains against the side of a tree. Lanceman's own brain is working too hard, trying to figure these men and their business. The crippled professor type, whose Tech 9 Lanceman is packing. The doctor with the concrete forehead. The deserted barracks room, the honor ranch that was no such thing. The strapping lads cooling their heels on the property. The golden man in the penguin sweater who will not tolerate a mess. Meanwhile, another segment of his brain is busy trying to gauge the air temperature. Call it 37, 38 degrees Fahrenheit. And from there to calculate or recall some table he might have seen once that gave the time it takes hypothermia to kill a Jewish policeman in his underpants. But the ruling cells of that great ruined organ, addled and drugged, are telling him only to run and keep on running. The woods give out abruptly, and he's standing in front of a machine shed. Molded gray panels of steel, no windows, with a rippled plastic roof. A scrotal pair of propane tanks huddles against the side of the building. The wind is sharper here, and Lanceman feels it like a flow of boiling water over his flesh. He runs around to the other side of the shed. It stands at the edge of a barren expanse of straw-covered ground. Way in the distance, a band of green grass dissolves into the rolling fog. A gravel track leads away from the shed, along the bare field of straw. 50 yards farther along, the track forks. One fork runs to the east, toward that band of green. The other runs on straight and disappears into a dark stand of trees. Lanceman turns back to the shed. A big door on rollers. Lanceman drags it thundering to one side. Disassembled refrigeration equipment. Cryptic pieces of machines. One wall covered in an Arabic written in lengths of black rubber hose. And right by the door, one of those three-wheeled electric carts called Zumzums, the district's #2 export after Shofar brand cellular telephones. This one is tricked out with a flatbed, the bed lined with a sheet of mud-streaked black rubber. Lanceman climbs up behind the wheel.
As cold as his ass already is, as cold as the wind is blowing down from the Yukon, the vinyl seat of that Zumzum is even colder. Lanceman thumbs its starter switch. He steps on the pedal, and with a thunk and a whir of differential gears, he's off. He rumbles up to the fork in the road and hesitates between the woods and that tranquil band of green grass, vanishing like a promise of peacefulness into the fog. Then he smashes down the pedal. Just before he plunges into the stand of trees, Lanceman looks back over his shoulder and sees the Yids of Peril Strait coming after him in a big black Ford Cordillo, splashing gravel as it rounds the corner of the supply shed. Lanceman has no idea where it came from, or, for that matter, how it got here. He didn't see any cars at all from the air. It's 500 meters behind the Zumzum and gaining easily. In the woods, gravel gives way to a rough track of packed earth that slips among handsome Sitka spruces, high and secretive. As Lanceman whirs along, he catches sight between the trees of a high chain-link fence topped by gay, glinting curls of razor wire. The steel mesh fence is woven with slats of green plastic. In places, a gap appears in the green weave of the fence. Through these gaps, Lanceman glimpses another steel shed, a clearing, posts, crossbeams, interlaced cables, a huge frame stretched with a web of cargo net, distended coils of barbed wire, rope swings. It might be an athletic facility, some kind of therapeutic playground for patients in recovery. Sure, and the people on the Cordillo might just be bringing him his pants. The black car is under 200 yards from him now. The passenger in its front seat rolls down his window and climbs out to sit on the top of his door, steadying himself with one hand on the roof rack. The other hand, Lantzman observes, is busy getting ready to fire a handgun. It's a fair, bearded young man in a black suit, cropped hair, a sober tie like Raboy's. He takes his time with the shot, reckoning the ever-dwindling distance. A flash blooms around his hand, and the back of the Zumzum explodes with a crack and a spray of fiberglass slivers. Lantzman lets out a cry and takes his foot off the accelerator pedal. So much for not making a mess. He bumps along on momentum for another 5 or 10 feet and then comes to a stop. The young man, hanging out of the Cordillo's window, raises his firing arm and judges the effect of his shot. The jagged hole in the fiberglass body of the Zumzum is probably disappointing to the poor kid, but he has to be happy about the fact that his moving target has just become stationary. His next shot is going to be a lot easier. The kid lowers his arm again with a patient slowness that is almost ostentatious, almost cruel. In his care and his parsimonious attitude toward bullets, Lantzman senses the hallmark of rigorous training and an athlete's grasp of eternity. Surrender unfurls across Lantzman's heart like the shadow of a flag. There is no way he can outrace the Cordillo, not in a shot-up Zumzum that on a good day tops out around 15 miles per hour. A warm blanket, maybe a hot cup of tea. These strike him as adequate recompense for failure. The Cordillo comes charging toward him and then sloshes to a halt in a spray of fallen needles. Three of its doors swing open and three men climb out, lumbering young yids in ill-fitting suits and meteor black shoes, steering their automatic pistols towards Lantzman. The guns seem to thrum in their hands as if they contain wildlife or gyroscopes. The gunmen can barely restrain them. Hard boys, neckties flying, their beards trimmed neat along the jawline, their skullcaps small crocheted saucers. The rear door on the near side remains firmly shut, but behind it Lantzman makes out the outline of a fourth man. The hard boys close on Lantzman in their matching suits, with their earnest haircuts. Lantzman stands up and turns around with his hands in the air. "You're clones, right?" he says as the three hard boys surround him. At the end of the picture, it always turns out to be clones. "Shut up," says the nearest hard boy, speaking American, and Lantzman is about to assent when he hears a sound like something both fibrous and doughy being slowly torn in two. In the time it takes him to observe in the eyes of the hard boys that they hear it, too, the sound sharpens and rises to a steady chopping, a sheet of paper caught in the blades of a fan. The sound grows louder and more layered, the hacking cough of an old man, a heavy wrench clanging against the cold cement floor, the flatulence of a burst balloon streaking across the living room and knocking over a lamp. Through the trees a light appears, stitching and staggering like a bumblebee, and suddenly, Lantzman knows it for what it is. "Dick," he says simply and not without wonder, and a shudder shakes him deep down to his bones. The light is an old 6-volt lamp, no more powerful than a large flashlight, flickering and wan in the gloom of the spruce forest. The engine that drives the light toward the party of Jews is a V-twin, custom-manufactured. You can hear the springs of the front forks as they register every jolt in the road. "Fuck him," mutters one of the hard boys, "and his fucking matchbox motorcycle." Lantzman has heard different stories about Inspector Willie Dick and his motorcycle. Some say that it was made for a full-grown Bombay millionaire of smaller-than-average stature. Others that it was originally presented as a 13th birthday gift to the Prince of Wales, and still others that it once belonged to a daredevil freak in a circus town in Texas or Alabama, or some exotic place like that. At first glance, it is a stock 1961 Royal Enfield Crusader, gunmetal gray in the sunlight, its stunning chromium trim carefully restored. You have to get up next to it, or see it alongside a normal-sized motorcycle, to realize that it is built to 2/3 scale. Willie Dick, though full-grown and 37 years old, is only 4 feet 7 inches tall. Dick rumbles past the Zumzum, squeaks to a stop, kills the elderly British engine. He climbs off the bike and comes swaggering over to Lantzman. "What the fuck?" he says, pulling off his gloves, black leather gauntlets of the sort that might be worn by Max von Sydow playing Erwin Rommel. His voice is always surprisingly rich and deep, given the boyishness of his frame. He describes a slow circuit of appraisal around the flower of Jewish law enforcement.
Detective Meyer Lantzman.
He turns to the hard boys and makes a study of their hardness. Gentlemen?
Inspector Dick,
says the one who told Lantzman to shut up. The boy has a jailhouse air, honed and stealthy, a toothbrush sharpened to a shiv.
What brings you to our neck of the woods?
With all due respect, Mr. Gold, it is Gold, right?
Yeah. This is my motherfucking neck of the woods.
Dick steps out from the group centered around Lantzman. He stares in to get a look at the shadow watching from behind the closed door of the Cordillo. Lantzman can't be certain, but whoever's there doesn't look big enough to be Raboy or the golden man in the penguin sweater. A hunched little shadow, furtive and watchful.
I was here before you, and I'll be here a long time after you yids are gone.
Detective Inspector Wilfred Dick is a full-blood Tlinkit, descended from the Chief Dick who inflicted the last recorded fatality in the history of Russian-Tlinkit relations, shooting and killing a marooned, half-starved Russian submariner he caught, raiding his crab traps at Stag Bay in 1948. Willie Dick is married, with 9 children, by his first and only wife, whom Lantzman has never seen. Naturally, she is reputed to be a giantess. In 1993 or 94, Dick successfully completed the Iditarod dog sled race, coming in 9th among 47 finishers. He has a Ph.D. in criminology from Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. Dick's first act as an adult male of his tribe was to travel, in an old Boston whaler, from the Dick Village at Stag Bay to Tribal Police Central Headquarters in Angoon, in order to persuade the superintendent to set aside, in his case, the minimum height requirement for tribal police officers. The stories of how this was accomplished are slanderous, salacious, hard to believe, or some combination of the three. Willie Dick has all the usual bad qualities of very small, very intelligent men. Vanity, arrogance, overcompetitiveness, a long memory for injuries and slights. He is also honest, dogged, and fearless, and he owes Lantzman a favor. Dick has a long memory for favors, too.
I'm trying to imagine what you mad Hebrews are up to, and every one of my theories is more fucked up than the last one, he says.
The man is a patient here, says Gold. He was trying to check out a little early is all.
So you were going to shoot him, Dick says. That's some badass fucking therapy, you guys. Damn. Strict Freudian, huh?
He turns back to Lantzman and looks him up and down. Dick's dark face is handsome, in a way, the avid eyes operating from the cover of a sage forehead, the chin dimpled, the nose straight and regular. The last time Lantzman saw him, Dick kept having to take a pair of reading glasses out of his shirt pocket and put them on. Now he has given in to senescence and adopted a slick, black and brushed steel pair of Italian spectacles, the kind worn in thoughtful interviews by aging British rock guitarists. He is dressed in stiff black jeans, black cowboy boots, and a red and black plaid shirt with an open collar. Over his shoulders he wears, as usual, a short cloak, held in place with a braided rawhide thong, made from the skin of a bear he hunted and killed himself. He is an affected creature, Willie Dick. He smokes black cigarettes, but he is a fine homicide detective.
Jesus Christ, Lantzman. You look like a fucking fetal pig I saw one time pickled in a jar.
He unties the braided thong with the fingers of one hand and shrugs out of the cloak. Then he tosses it to Lantzman. For an instant, it's as cold as steel against Lantzman's body, then wonderfully warm. Dick keeps the grin of mockery in place, but for Lantzman's benefit, only Lantzman can see it, extinguishes every last trace of humor from his eyes.
I spoke to that ex-wife of yours, he says in a near whisper, the voice he uses to threaten suspects and intimidate witnesses. After I got your message... You have less fucking right to be here than a fucking eyeless African mole rat.
He raises his voice nearly to the point of staginess.
Detective Lantzman, what did I tell you I was going to do to your Jewish ass the next time I caught you running around Indian country without benefit of clothing?
I don't remember, Lantzman says, seized by a violent tremor of gratitude and exposure. You said so many things.
Dick walks over to the Cordillo and knocks on the closed door like he wants to come in. The door opens and Dick stands behind it and converses in a low voice with whoever is sitting inside, keeping warm. After a moment, Dick comes back and tells Gold, "Man in charge wants to speak to you." Gold goes around the open door to talk to the man in charge. When he comes back, he looks like his sinuses have been pulled out through his ears, and he blames Lantzman for it. He nods once to Dick.
"Detective Lantzman," Dick says,
"I'm very much fucking afraid that you are under arrest."
32.
In the emergency room at the Indian Hospital in St. Cyril, the Indian doctor looks Lantzman over and pronounces him fit to be jailed. The doctor's name is Rao, and he's from Madras, and he's heard all of the jokes before. He's handsome in that Salminio style, big obsidian eyes and a mouth like a cake icing rose. Mild frostbite, he tells Lantzman, nothing serious. Though 1 hour and 47 minutes after his rescue, Lantzman still can't seem to suppress the temblors that rise from inner faults to shake his body. Cold to the honeycomb of his bones.
"Where's the big dog with the little thing of brandy around his neck?" Lantzman says after the doctor tells him he can take off the blanket and put on the jailhouse clothes that lie in a neat stack beside the sink. "When does he show up?"
"Do you enjoy brandy?"
Dr. Rao says, as if he's reading from a phrase book, as if he has not the slightest interest either in his question or in any answer that Lantzman might ever produce. Lantzman tags it at once as a classic interrogator's tone, so cold that it leaves a burn. Dr. Rao's gaze remains resolutely fixed on an empty corner of the room.
"Is that something you feel you need?"
"Who said anything about needing?" Lantzman says, fumbling with the buttonfly of some worn twill trousers. Cotton work shirt, laceless canvas sneaks. They want to dress him like a wino or a beach bum or some other kind of loser who turns up naked at your intake desk, homeless, no visible means of support. The shoes are too big, but otherwise everything's a perfect fit.
"No craving?"
There's a fleck of ash in the A of the doctor's name tag. He picks at it with a fingernail.
"You're not feeling the need of a drink right now?"
"Maybe I just want one," Lantzman says. "Did you ever think of that?"
"Maybe,"
the doctor says.
"Or maybe you are fond of large, salivating dogs."
"Okay, knock it off, Doc," Lantzman says. "Let's not play games."
"All right."
Dr. Rao turns his plump face to Lantzman. The irises of his eyes are like cast iron.
"Based on my examination, I would guess that you are going through alcoholic withdrawal, Detective Lantzman. In addition to exposure, you're also suffering from dehydration, tremors, palpitations, and your pupils are enlarged. Your blood sugar is low, which tells me you probably haven't been eating. Loss of appetite is another symptom of withdrawal. Your blood pressure is elevated, and your recent behavior appears to have been, from what I gather, quite erratic, even violent."
Lantzman tugs on the wrinkled lapels of the collar of his chambray work shirt, trying to smooth them out. Like cheap window blinds, they keep rolling themselves up. "Doctor," he says, "from one man with X-ray eyeballs to another, I respect your keenness, but tell me, please, if the country of India were being cancelled, and in 2 months, along with everyone you loved, you were going to be tossed into the jaws of the wolf with nowhere to go and no one to give a fuck, and half the world had just spent the past 1,000 years trying to kill Hindus, don't you think you might take up drinking?"
"That or ranting to strange doctors."
"The dog with the brandy never gets wise with the frozen guy," Lantzman says wistfully.
"Detective Lantzman."
"Yes, Doc."
"I have been examining you for the last 11 minutes, and in that time you have produced 3 prolonged speeches. Rants, I would call them."
"Yes," Lantzman says, and now his blood begins to flow for the first time, into his cheeks. "It happens sometimes."
"You like to make speeches?"
"They come and go."
"Verbal jags."
"I've heard them called that." For the first time, Lantzman notices that Dr. Rao is secretly chewing something, working it with his back teeth. The faint smell of anise leaks from his frosting pink lips. The doctor makes a note on Lantzman's chart.
"Are you currently under the care of a psychiatrist, or taking any medication for depression?"
"Depression? I seem depressed to you?"
"It's really just a word," the doctor says. "I'm looking at possible symptoms. From what Inspector Dick has told me, and from my examination,